High up on the poop is leading the Italians into battle, the Senate and people with him, his home gods and the great gods. Two flames shoot up from his helmet in jubilant light, and his father's star dawns over its crest. Elsewhere in the scene is Agrippa. The gods and the winds fight for him, prominent, leading his column. The naval crown with its miniature ship's beaks, a proud decoration of war, shines on his head. On the other side, with barbaric wealth and motley equipment, is Antony, fresh from his triumphs in the east, by the shores of the Indian Ocean. Egypt, the powers of the Orient and uttermost Bactra sail with him. Also, a shameful thing, his Egyptian wife. The fleets are converging at full speed. The sea is all churned and foaming as the oarsmen take their long strokes and the trident bows drive on. They manoeuvre for sea room. You'd think the Cyclades Isles were unmoored and afloat, or mountains were charging at mountains to see those massive galleys on one side attacking the turreted ships of the other. Volleys of flaming material and iron missiles fly thick and fast. A strange new slaughter reddens the plains of Neptune. In the midst, Cleopatra rallies her fleet with Egyptian timbrel, for she cannot yet see the two serpents of death behind her. Barking Anubis, a whole progeny of grotesque deities are embattled against Neptune and Minerva and Venus. Mars is raging in the thick of the fight, his figure wrought from iron, and ominous furies look on from above. Here Discord strides exulting in her torn mantle, and she is followed by Bellona wielding a blood-stained scourge. Viewing this, Apollo of Actium draws his bow from aloft. It creates a panic. All the Egyptians, all the Indians, Arabians, and Sabaeans now turn tail. You could see the queen, Cleopatra, praying a fair wind, making all sail, in the very act of paying the sheets out and running. The fire god had rendered her, pale with the shadow of her own death amid the carnage, borne on by the waves and the westerly gale. And, over against her, the Nile, sorrowing in all its length, throws wide the folds of its watery garment, inviting the conquered to sail for refuge into that blue, protective bosom. But Caesar has entered the walls of Rome in triumphal procession, three times a victor. He dedicates now a thanks offering immortal to Italy's gods, 300 great shrines all over the city. The streets resound with cheering, rejoicing, and merrymaking. In all the temples, women are chanting, altars are lit up. At the foot of the altars lie the bodies of sacrificed bullocks. Caesar, enthroned in the marble-white temple of dazzling Apollo, inspects the gifts from the nations and hangs them up on the splendid portals. Subjected tribes pass by in a long procession. A diversity of tongues, of national dress and equipment. Here Vulcan had represented the nomads, the flowing robes of Africans. Here the Leleges, Carians, Gelonian bowmen. Some carry a picture of Euphrates, its waters pacified. There go the Morini, furthest of men, the branching Rhine, the Scythians untamed, the Araxes fretting about its bridge. Such were the scenes that Aeneas admired on the shield of Vulcan his mother gave him. Elated by its portrayal of things beyond his ken, he shouldered his people's glorious future. Book 9. Now while Aeneas was thus engaged in a far distant part of the country, Saturnian Juno sent down Iris from heaven to the fiery Turnus. He, as it happened, was then taking his ease in the hallowed vale of Pilumnus, his forefather. Rose-lipped Iris, daughter of Thormas, thus addressed him. Turnus, what none of the gods would dare to promise, however you prayed, has been brought about by the mere passage of time. Aeneas, leaving his fleet, his friends, and his settlement, has gone afar to the Palatine kingdom, the home of Evander. Nay, more, he has made his way to remote Etruscan cities, is gathering armed levies among the Lydian yeomen. Why hesitate? Now is the time to call for horses and chariots. Move fast. Make a surprise attack on his camp and capture it. So she said. Then, soaring to heaven on balanced wings, blazed a rainbow trail beneath the clouds as she flew. Turnus recognized her divinity, raised his two hands heavenwards, and sent these words after the fleeting goddess. Iris, glory of the sky! Who was it conveyed you, cloud-born, down to me here on earth? How came this sudden brightness up there? For I can see the firmament roll apart and the vagrant stars unveiled. I acknowledge the sign, whoever you are that call me to battle. Turnus, with these words, went to the waterside, scooped up water out of the brimming stream, and offered many prayers and vows to the gods above. Soon, his whole army was marching across the open plains, a mass of chargers, a mass of gold-embroidered apparel. Messapus is marshalling the advance guard, Tyrus sons the rear, while the main body is under the command of Turnus, who rides there fully armed, a head higher than all. Even as Ganges or Nile, all seven tranquil branches silently rise in flood, and then, withdrawing from the low lands their fertilizing water, return to their channels again. Now did the Trojans see, as they looked forth, a dust cloud suddenly formed, a darkness mounting above the plain. Caicus was first to spy it from the rampart and raise the alarm. Hey there! What is that body looms up in a gloom of dust? To arms! Jump to it! Issue the weapons! Man the walls! The enemy is upon us! There were loud shouts as the Trojans came hurrying in through all the gates and lined the battlements. Aeneas, that excellent soldier, had instructed them so to do before he left. If such an emergency should arise in his absence, they must not risk deploying to fight in the open, only defend the camp from behind the rampart's protection. So now, though rage and humiliation tempt them to mix it, they secure the gates, just as Aeneas had told them, take cover inside the turrets, ready their weapons and wait the foe. Turnus, who'd shot ahead of his cumbrously moving column with a bodyguard of 20 picked horsemen, got to the camp unexpectedly soon. The Thracian charger he rode had markings of white, and he wore a helmet of gold with blood-red plume. "Will any of you be the first lads with me against the foe to... Watch me!" he cried, and hurled a javelin into the blue, a prelude of battle, then stately advanced out on the field. His companions acclaimed it with cheers and followed him with blood-curdling war cries. They were amazed at the Trojans' inactivity, amazed that such warriors did not come out on the open plain and there oppose them, but huddled in the camp. Impatiently, Turnus rode this way and that round the walls, seeking a way in where none was. Just as a wolf that lurks near to some crowded sheepfold, howling around the pens, with rainstorms driving upon him, and late at night, meanwhile the lambs safe under their mothers bleat and bleat, the wolf, in a fury of exasperation, snarls at the prey he cannot reach, for long, sharpening, grinding hunger has driven him wild, and his throat is parched for blood. Just so did Turnus gaze at the camp's fortifications with mounting rage. His chagrin burned him right to the bone as he cast about for some way to get at the Trojans, dislodge them from their besieged emplacements, and tumble them out in the open. Their fleet, which lay concealed close to one flank of the camp, protected all round by earthworks and the river itself, he now moved against. Told his exulting men to bring incendiaries, snatched up a blazing pine torch himself in his hot excitement. How they went to it then! The presence of Turnus inspired them. Soon the hearths had been stripped, and every soldier was armed with a smoking firebrand. The resinous torches were spouting up to the sky a murky glare which gave off volleys of sparks. What deity was it, O Muses, averted that merciless blaze from the Trojans? Who drove away so fierce a fire from their ships? Tell me. The proofs are deep buried in the past, but the tale is undying. At the time when, in Phrygian Ida, Aeneas was beginning to build a fleet and preparing to venture forth on the deep sea, Cybele herself, mother of the gods, is said to have made this appeal to mighty Jupiter. Grant me, my son, what I ask, what your dear mother asks who helped you to power in Olympus. I had a forest of pine trees, cherished for many a year, a plantation high up on the mountain, dusky with glooming spruces and maple wood. Men used to bring me offerings there. This did I gladly give to the Dardan prince when he needed a fleet. But now a dreadful anxiety gnaws and troubles me. Banish my fears. Let a mother's prayer be so far efficacious that neither hurricanes nor any other stress of voyaging vanquish those ships. May they find it a blessing they came from my mountain. Her son, who turns the heavenly constellations, replied, What would you bend the fates to? What is this you are asking, my mother? For those ships, may vessels built by mortal hands have immortals' privilege? Or Aeneas go, sure of immunity, through hazards whose issue is unsure? No god has the power to grant that. No. When they've accomplished their task, and lie at journey's end one day in Italian harbour, such ships as escape the sea and carry the Dardan hero to the Laurentine land, I shall relieve of their mortal shape, and command they become goddesses of the great deep, like Doto, Nereus' child, and Galatea, who cleave the foaming sea with their breasts. So Jupiter spoke, and then by the stream of his Stygian brother, the banks where boiling pitch flows in a black maelstrom, he nodded, confirming his promise. The nod caused all Olympus to tremble. So now that promised day was here, the allotted time, fulfilled by the fate spinners. Cybele now was warned by the outrage Turnus intended to ward off the fire from her sacred ships. First did a strange light blaze upon their eyes, and a huge cloud was seen to career across the sky from the eastwards, loud with the crashing of Cybele's cymbals. A voice that awed them broke from the cloud and fell about the ears of Trojans and Rutuli. Teucrians, do not trouble yourselves to defend my ships. Put by your weapons, for Turnus shall sooner burn up the sea than those blessed ships of mine. Go forth, enfranchised barks, as goddesses of the sea. The mother bids you. At once each vessel snapped the moorings that held her stern to the bank, and all, burying their beaks in the water, plunged deep down like dolphins. Soon they surfaced again, but, wonder of wonders, each was a maiden now, as they coursed over the sea. Each ship that had been lying bronze-beaked along the shore. The Rutuli were dumbfounded. Messapus himself was terrified. His horses reared in panic. The river, harshly growling, checked its flow. Yes, Tiber recoiled from the deep sea then. But the fiery Turnus did not lose confidence. Far from it. He spoke to raise their spirits. He even rebuked his men. This portent is pointed against the Trojans. Jove himself has removed their usual standby. Their ships are not staying to face Rutulian fire and steel. Well, the seaways are closed to the Teucrians, and that was their only escape route. One half of the world is lost them, while we have command of the land, since in their thousands the tribes of Italy have flocked to arms. I am not in the least dismayed by this or that God-given ruling of destiny they may boast of. The Fates and Venus have had their payoff, in that the Trojans have reached our fertile land of Ausonia. I, too, have oracles backing me. I am to root out this damnable race with the sword in revenge for their stealing my bride, a resentment not only the sons of Atreus can feel. Others may take up arms for the same cause. Let the Trojans say, it's enough to have once been ruined. I say, it should be enough to have sinned once, and then to loathe well-nigh all the feminine sex. It's quaint how a rampart between, a delaying system of trenches, frail barricades against death, have given them courage and confidence. Have they not seen Troy's battlements, built by the hand of Neptune, collapse into the flames? But you, my storm troops, which of you is ready to hack his way at my side through the rampart and break into their flustered defences? I don't need arms from Vulcan or 1,000 ships before I'll fight the Trojans. Let all the Etruscans flock to their side this very minute. The foe need fear no cowardly theft of Athene's image in darkness, with the sentries up on the citadel murdered. Nor are we going to hide in a horse's dark paunch. By day, from the open, I mean to fire their wall's perimeter. I'll make them realize they're not dealing with Danaans or with Pelasgian troops, such as Hector fought off till the 10th year. For the present, since the better part of today is over, you shall have the rest to recuperate. Set up by the knowledge that so far you have done well, the assurance that I am preparing for battle. Messapus was given charge now of watching the enemy's gates with pickets and lighting a ring of fires around the perimeter. 14 Rutulian officers were picked for the duty to keep watch on the camp. Each led a detachment 100 strong, in golden, glittering accoutrements with red plumes on their helmets. Briskly they pass to and fro, relieved and relievers. They sprawl on the grass to take their wine, tilting the bowls of bronze. Brightly shine the watchfires. The watchers keep awake by gaming through the night. The Trojans, standing to arms on the ramparts above, looked down at these operations. In a bustle of alarm, they tested the bars of their gates and laid out gangways communicating between the strong points, carrying arms as they did so. Nicias and gallant Serestus urged on this work. The two whom Aeneas had chosen to be field commanders and civil governors in case of emergency. Their whole force manned the walls, drawing lots for the points of danger, and mounted guard in turn, each at his post as ordered. One gate was held by Nisus, that most aggressive of fighters. He was Hyrtacus' son, and had come from the hunting grounds of Ida to follow Aeneas. A lightning shot with arrow or javelin. Euryalus was beside him, his friend. No man of Aeneas, no wearer of Trojan arms was handsomer than he, that lad with the bloom of youth on his unshaven cheeks. These two were one in love. They would charge into battle together. Tonight they were doing sentry duty at the same gate. Nisus said, "Is it God that makes one burn to do brave things? Or does each of us make a god of his own fierce passion to do them? For long I've been itching to hurl myself into a fight, or venture some notable deed. Inaction and calm do not appeal to me. Look at the confidence the Rutuli have in their fortunes. Far apart glimmer their watchfires, unstrung by wine and sleep they are prostrate. All is silence down there. Well, listen to what I'm debating in my mind, the idea that comes to me now. Everyone, commons and councillors alike, has been saying that we must send for Aeneas, send men with official news of what's happened. If they promise you the reward I shall ask, for myself the glory of the deed is enough. I believe, under cover of yonder high ground, I can find a way through to the fortified town of Pelantium." Euryalus was dazed, struck by the same great zest for glory. At once he spoke to his eager friend like this, "Nisus, you wouldn't fight shy of having me as your comrade in such an adventure? Could I let you go into danger without me? Not so did my father, the veteran soldier Opheltes, teach me, who brought me up in the midst of the Argive terror, the ordeal of Troy. Nor, during our friendship, have I done aught to make you doubt me, as I followed great-heart Aeneas wherever his destiny led us. I am no clinger to life, not I, but rather one who believes it were well exchanged for the renown you aim at." Nisus replied, "I had no such fears about you, I swear it. That would be wrong indeed. May Jove, or however we should name him, who looks on these things with favour, restore me to you triumphant. But if, as so often happens in desperate affairs like this, some accident or God should send my plans awry, I would like you to survive me. You're young, with your life before you. May there be one to rescue my corpse from the fray, or ransom it, and, in our fashion, inter it, or, if some chance should prevent that, to build a handsome cenotaph, and to bring offerings there. Nor do I want to cause your poor mother such terrible anguish, dear lad, who alone of Troy's elderly women would have no truck with Acestes' city, but bravely came on with you here." But Euryalus made answer, "It's no use your bringing out all these arguments, for my mind is made up, and you cannot shift me. Let us get down to it quickly." At once he awoke the guard, who relieved them and took their watch. Leaving his post, he walked at the side of Nisus, his friend, and they went to look for the prince. All other living creatures on earth were asleep, their worries dissolved in sleep, their minds oblivious of toil and trouble. But the high command of the Trojans, the flower of the people, were holding a conference on the critical state of affairs, discussing what they should do, and whom they should send to report to Aeneas. Leaning upon their long spears, with shields on their arms, they stand in the center of the camp's parade ground. Euryalus and Nisus come hurrying up, and eagerly beg an immediate audience. "An important matter," they say, "well worth the interruption." Ascanius greeted the impatient pair, told Nisus to speak. He began like this, "Gentlemen, please give a kindly hearing to what we propose, and do not dismiss it as coming from men so junior to you. Relaxed by drinking and sleep, the Rutuli are silent all. We have noticed a possible place for a stealthy breakout. It lies by the seaward gate where two ways fork. The ring of watchfires is broken there, some being extinguished, others all smoke. If you'll let us make use of this bit of luck to go in quest of Aeneas to fortified Palantium, you'll soon see us back again, and laden with spoils, having done great execution on the foe. We shall not mistake our way either, for we have sighted that town from below in the valley coverts where often we go hunting, and have got to know the whole river. Then spoke the aged Aletes, a man of mature judgment. Gods of our fathers, beneath whose protection Troy remains always, you cannot, for all that has happened, intend to destroy us completely, when you have brought us young men of such spirit and such a resolute character. Even as he spoke, he put his arms round their shoulders and gripped their hands, with the tears rivering down his cheeks. My lads, what recompense can I think of for you, that's at all worthy of an enterprise so glorious? The first and fairest reward will come from heaven and your own virtue. In addition, Aeneas the True will repay you promptly, and also Ascanius, whose life is before him, who's never forgetful of noble service. Ascanius at once took it up. Why, yes, I adjure you, I, whose salvation lies in my father's return, adjure by the great gods of home, the first family god of Assaracus, and the shrine of revered Vesta. My fortunes, my every hope for the future, I lay in your hands, Nisus. Bring back my father, oh, let me see him again. If he comes, all our dejection goes. I will give 2 goblets made of silver and richly encrusted with figures. My father took them as spoils at the sack of Arisba. Also a pair of tripods, 2 full talents of gold, and an antique bowl, a present from Carthaginian Dido. But if it befalls that we win the war and become masters of a conquered Italy, so that I portion out the spoils, you saw the horse which Turnus was riding, and his golden armour? That same horse, that shield, and the red-plumed helmet I shall set aside. Consider them yours, my reward to you, Nisus. Besides, my father shall give you 12 women of choicest beauty, and as many male captives too, each with his own equipment. In addition to these, you shall have the private estates of Latinus. Now, Euryalus, for you. I admire you greatly, and I am not far behind you in age, so I take you now to my heart. You shall be my friend and share my fortunes, whatever they are. I shall never seek renown for myself without you beside me. Whether in peace or war, I shall put the utmost reliance on you for word and deed. Euryalus made answer, You shall never be disillusioned by my falling away from so brave a beginning as this. Let only my luck stay good and not turn sour on me. But, apart from what you have given, I beg one boon. My mother, a lady of Priam's ancient lineage, would not remain behind in the land of Ilium or settle in Acestes' township, poor soul, but has travelled with me. I am leaving her now. She knows naught of these dangers I have to face, whatever they are, without saying goodbye, because I swear it by night and your own right hand, her tears would be sure to unman me. Helpless she'll be, and lonely. I implore you, befriend and console her. If I know I can count on you for this, I shall go the more bravely to meet what I have to meet. Deeply touched by his words, the Trojans shed some tears, especially fair Ascanius, at the image of filial love thus printed upon his mind. Then he began like this, All shall be done, as befits your great enterprise, I assure you. Indeed, I will be a son to your mother, and she shall become Creusa in all but name. Much kindness is coming to her who bore such a son. Whatever the consequences of your action, by my own head, which my father was wont to swear by, I swear it. All that I've promised to give you if you return successful, the same shall hold good for your mother and for your kin always." So Ascanius spoke, in tears. Then he unslung from his shoulder the gold-hilted sword which Lycaon of Knossos had fashioned with wonderful workmanship and had fitted with an ivory sheath for carrying. Nicias presented to Nisus the shaggy skin of a lion, while good Aletes exchanged his own helm for the helmet of Nisus. At once, full-armed, the pair moved off. The Trojan leaders escorted them to the gate, old and young in a body, with prayers for their safety. Ascanius, who had a grown man's sense of responsibility and an old head on young shoulders, gave them many commissions to take to his father. But all was whirled aloft by the winds, atomized, went for nothing. Sallying out, they crossed the earthworks and made through the dark night towards the fatal camp. Fatal for them, though first they would be death to many. All over the grass they see bodies asprawl in drunken sleep, chariots parked by the shore, men lying amidst the harness and wheels, a litter of weapons and wine-cups together. Nisus began to say, "Euryalus, we must risk it. Now is our opportunity. Here lies our route. You must guard me and keep a lookout all behind us, on the alert for any who tries to attack from the rear. I'm going to make havoc here, and hack a broad path for your feet." These words he whispered no more, and at once he thrust with his sword at the haughty Rhamnes, who chanced to be lying nearby on a great heap of rugs, his broad chest heaving in slumber. He was a king himself, but also the prophet most favoured by King Turnus. Now his prophetic gifts could not avert his doom. Then Nisus killed three attendants who lay off guard at his side among their weapons, with Remus, squire, and his charioteer, whom he found at the horse's feet, and severed their lolling heads. Next he beheaded their master, Remus, and left his trunk throbbing out jets of blood like sobs. The warm, wet blood darkened his couch and the ground. Lamyrus, Lamus he slew, and young Serranus, a man of exceptional looks, who'd begun the night with an orgy of gaming and now was lying completely insensible from wine. Well for him if he'd gone on gambling all night, protracted his play into the morning. So does a famishing lion, driven by insensate hunger, run amok through the crowded sheepfolds, mauling and dragging the meek sheep, mute with terror, and roars from his blood-stained mouth. No less was the damage done by Euryalus. Unlagging in fury, he surprised and killed Fardus, Herbesus, Rhoetus, Abaris, and many others who lay in his path unconscious. Rhoetus was actually awake, a witness of all this, but in extreme terror was crouching behind a big wine jar. His enemy got him full in the breast at close quarters, just as he rose, drove the sword right through him, withdrew it in spouts of blood. Rhoetus poured out his life, all crimson. Dying, he coughed up blood and wine. The other pressed on with his stealthy killing. Now he was nearing the lines of Messapus, where he could see the watchfire burning low and the horses, properly tethered, browsing upon the grass. At this moment Nisus, aware that his friend was being carried too far by bloodlust, called out to him, "Let's stop. It will be light soon, and light is no friend to us. We have taken toll enough. We have cut a swathe through the enemy." They had to leave behind a wealth of solid silver accoutrements, of drinking bowls and magnificent carpets, the ornaments Rhamnes had worn on his breast and his gold-studded baldric. They were presents originally sent to Remulus of Tibur by the rich Caedicus to obtain his friendship in absence. Remulus on his deathbed bequeathed them to his grandson. Then they became the battle spoils of the Rutuli. These did Euryalus whip off and put over his own strong shoulders, a short-lived prize. He donned Messapus' well-fitting helmet with its gay plume. Then they left the camp and made for safety. Meanwhile, a cavalry force sent ahead from the Latin city, while the rest of the army remained in formation upon the plain, were on their way carrying dispatches to King Turnus. 300 with modern equipment and a command of Volscens. Now they were nearing the camp, almost beneath its ramparts, when they saw at a distance the pair turning off by a path to their left hand, Euryalus being betrayed by the helmet he'd thoughtlessly clapped on, reflecting the moonbeams among the glimmering shades of night. That sight was not lost on them. From the head of the column cried Volscens, "Halt there! What is your business? Who are you that carry arms, and where are you off to?" The pair made no reply to this challenge, but hurried on into the wood, hoping the darkness would save them. The horsemen, knowing the place well, stationed themselves at the crossways on either hand, and cordoned the wood to stop each exit. That wood was an unkempt tangle of bushes and black holm oaks right through, and everywhere thickly overgrown with brambles. Here and there showed their path among a confusion of dim tracks. Euryalus, who was hampered by the weight of his spoils, unsighted and hindered by the branches, in fright lost his direction. Nisus got clear away. Forgetting his friend, he had slipped the foe and reached the place which later was called Alba, after Albanus, but then housed the royal herds of Latinus, when, halting, he looked back. In vain, for his comrade was not behind him. "Euryalus, my poor dear friend, where did I leave you? Where shall I look for you? Should I retrace all my ravelled path through that bewildering wood?" At once he turns back, and carefully following the trail he'd made, roves through the hushed thickets. Soon he can hear horses and the din that means a pursuit. Not long now before a loud cry comes to his ears, and he sees his friend whom, tricked by the mazy wood and the darkness, bemused by their sudden attack, the whole mob has pounced on, and now is dragging away, overpowered, frantically, vainly, struggling. What can Nisus do? What weapons or strength can avail him to rescue the lad? Or shall he just hurl himself to destruction upon their swords, to die quickly and honourably of his wounds? On the instant he draws back his arm, with spear poised ready to throw, and looking up at the moon above, he says this prayer: "Goddess, be with me, and help me in what I have to do. Latona's child, supremest of stars and warden of woodlands, if ever my father Hyrtacus brought offerings to your altar on my behalf, if I've honoured you with the spoils of the chase, hung them within your dome or on your hallowed rooftop, grant me to rout this mob and speed my weapons unerringly." Then, putting all his body into the throw, he hurled the spear. It flew with a swish through the shadowy night and struck Sulmo, whose back was turned, from behind. The shaft broke there, but the splintered wood drove on, piercing the wall of the heart. Spouting warm blood from his breast, Sulmo went rolling. The chill of death came upon him. His flanks heaved with long-drawn gaspings. His comrades looked round them everywhere. Nisus, the more aggressive for this, was poising another weapon above his ear-tip. With the foe quite at a loss, it went right through both temples of Tagus, and warmly weltering, stuck in the brain it transfixed. Volscens, unable to see the assailant anywhere, or what direction to charge in, was bloody-hearted with rage. "All right. In the meantime, you shall pay the account for these two with your own lifeblood. he cried, and instantly, drawing his sword, he went for Euryalus. Then, frightened out of his wits, Nisus gave a yell. He could not any longer remain concealed by the darkness or stand such terrible anguish. "Here! I am standing here! I did it! Oh, Rutuli, turn your weapons on me! It was all my doing! He couldn't have harmed you or tried to. I swear it by heaven and the all-seeing stars. Only he loved too well a friend who has brought him bad luck." So Nisus spoke. But the sword, violently thrust, had passed through the ribs, and while he yet spoke, was boring a hole in the white breast. Euryalus rolled over, dying. The blood ran down his beautiful limbs, and his neck dropped feebly onto one shoulder. So, when its stalk is cut by the plowshare, a shining flower grows limp and dies, or poppies droop down their heads upon the languid stems when the weight of a shower is too much for them. But Nisus went straight in at the foe. He was after Volscens and nobody else. Nothing would stop him getting at Volscens. Closely hemming him round on this side and that, they struggle to fight him off. But he presses forward, all the more furiously, whirling his sword in arcs of lightning, until he has slashed it full in the screaming face of Volscens, and dying, slain him. Then, riddled with wounds, he throws himself down over his lifeless friend, and there, at last, grows still in the calm of death. Ah, fortunate pair! If my poetry has any influence, time in its passing shall never obliterate your memory. As long as the house of Aeneas dwell by the Capitol's moveless rock, and the head of the Roman family keeps his power. Now the victorious Rutuli stripped the spoils from the bodies, and weeping carried the lifeless Volscens into their camp. Lamentation waxed there when they found Ramnes dead and so many of their best men, like Numa and Serranus, killed in the same massacre. A crowd collected around the dead and dying, the spot where the ground was warm and reeking with the late slaughter, and blood ran like rivers foaming in spate. The spoils were identified. Messapus' glittering helmet and the breast adornments of Ramnes recovered with so much effort. And now was Aurora, leaving the saffron bed of Tithonus, beginning to shower upon earth the light of another day. As soon as the sun was risen and there was light to see by, Turnus, in full armour, whipped up his men to fight. Each captain mustered for battle his bronze-accoutred company, all with their anger whetted by tales of the night's doings. What's more, a shocking sight, impaled on spears, uplifted, and followed by the shouting Rutuli, were the heads of Euryalus and Nisus. On the left flank of their ramparts, the right being well protected by the river, the tough troops of Aeneas took up position. They man the system of trenches, or stand on the turrets above, in low spirits, and shocked to see the impaled heads. Those two familiar faces, alas, dripping with black gore. Meantime, winged Rumour, flitting over the shaken encampment, came with post-haste news and swooped to the ears of the mother of Euryalus. Poor woman! Her bones suddenly turned to ice. The shuttle was dashed from her hands, the thread unwound. A pathetic figure, she darted out, wailing and keening, tearing her hair, and frantically made for the walls, the front line of defenders. She was regardless of the men stationed there, or the danger of flying missiles. Loudly now she lamented, "Oh, Euryalus, to see you like this! How could you leave me desolate, oh, heartless, you, the solace of my sere old age?
And to think that you went on so dangerous a mission without your poor mother being allowed to say farewell to you. Oh, God! You are lying a prey to the dogs and birds of Latium on alien soil. And I, your mother, have not brought you, your body, to burial. Not closed the eyes nor washed the wounds, nor wrapped you in the robe I had been busily working for you by day and night to distract my old mind from its troubles. Where shall I seek you? In what place are lying your mutilated body, your severed limbs? Is this all of yourself you bring me back, this head? Was it this I journeyed by land and sea for? Rutuli, if you have any human feelings, oh, kill me. Turn all your weapons upon me. Let me be the first to die. Or else may the Father of Heaven take pity on me and finish this life I hate, striking me down with his fire to Hades, since I've no other way to end my cruel existence. Her wailing shook their hearts. A general groan of sorrow went up. They were benumbed, and had lost all spirit for fighting. As she was fanning their grief, by the orders of Ilioneus and the bitterly weeping Ascanius, Idaeus, and Actor lifted her up in their arms and carried her back into her dwelling. Then did the brazen tongue of the trumpet utter afar its terrible call. War cries went up, and the whole sky bellowed. Under a driving, tight-fitting roof of shields, the Italians charged, essaying to fill in the trenches and break through the breastwork. Some of them tried to get in by scaling the walls on ladders at a point where the ring of defenders was thinnest and daylight showed between their spaced-out bodies. In reply, the Trojans rained all kinds of missile and thrust down with tough pikes at the attackers, being trained by long experience of siege to defend their battlements. Ponderous, deadly rocks they pitched down too, in an effort to shatter that armoured column. But these, beneath their compact casemate of shields, were in good shape to take whatever might come down. But now they failed. For where the great press of assailants threatened, the Trojans rolled up an enormous boulder and tipped it over, which, falling, burst through the casemate of shields, knocked down the Rutuli like ninepins. The latter, though brave men, were now less keen to engage in such a blind, head-on assault. So they tried to drive the defenders off the ramparts by sniping. On another sector, Mezentius, ferocious of aspect, brandished Etruscan torches, attacked with smoking incendiaries, while Messapus, tamer of horses, a son of Neptune, hacked through the palisade and shouted for ladders to scale the battlements. Calliope, I pray that the muses inspire my song to tell what execution the sword of Turnus now wrought there, what deaths, what men each fighting man dispatched to Hades. I pray you unroll with me the spacious map of the battle, for you are divine, you remember it all and can recount it. There stood, in a key position, a turret tall and sheer, and linked with gangways aloft. This the Italians were struggling with all their might to storm, putting all their skill to its overthrow. While for their part, the Trojans fought back, volleying stones, keeping up a heavy fire of arrows through its embrasures. At the head of his men, Turnus now hurled a lighted fire dart, which stuck in the tower's side, blazing. Fanned by the wind, it rapidly spread fire all over the planking, consumed the door it was lodged in. Alarm and confusion seized the defenders within. They sought to escape their doom, but in vain. Jammed together, they pressed back to the side of the tower that was free from fire, but suddenly, bodily, the tower collapsed and fell with a crash that resounded to heaven. Half dead, they were pitched to the ground, the huge mass of the tower avalanching upon them, impaled by their own weapons, with splinters of tough wood spitting their bodies through. Helenor and Lycus alone just managed to scramble clear. Helenor, a man in the prime of youth, was the natural son of the Lydian king by a slave from Lysimna, who'd sent him to fight at Troy. Though forbidden, a light-armed swordsman with no reputation in war, no device on his shield. As soon as he saw that he was hemmed in by the hordes of Turnus, a ring of Latin troops, rank upon rank around him, like some wild beast walled in by a thick cordon of hunters, which furiously snarls at their weapons, and knowing she's doomed, with a great spring hurls herself to her death upon the hunting spears, even so did the young man charge right into the press of the foe, where he saw their weapons were thickest, as one who was bound to die. But Lycus, being much swifter a runner, made good his escape through all the hostile arms as far as the rampart, and now he was struggling to grip its parapet and clutch the hands of his comrades. But Turnus, who'd been in hot pursuit and had hurled a weapon, triumphantly taunted him thus, "You half-wit! Did you really think you could give us the slip?" Then he seized the man as he clung there and tore him off. A large piece of the wall came away with him. It was like when the war-bird of Jove has seized a hare or a snow-white swan in its crooked talons and soars aloft to its eyrie. Or the wolf of Mars has snatched from the fold a lamb which its mother looks for with long-drawn bleatings. On the whole front the din crescendoed, the foe running in and bridging the trenches with rubble, while some of them tossed incendiaries up at the wall-tops above. With a rock as big as a chunk of mountain, Ilioneus now felled Lucetius, who was close to the gate with a firebrand. Emathion was killed by Liger, Corineus by Asilas, Liger good with his spear, Asilas at long-range bow-shots. Ortygius went down to Cineus, who then was killed by Turnus. Turnus as well slew Itys, Clonius, Dioxippus, Promulus, Sagaris, and Idas, who stood in defence of a turret. Capys killed Privernus, who had just received a flesh wound from the spear of Themilla. He foolishly let go his shield and clapped his hand to the wound. So now the flighted arrow of Capys pinned his hand to his left side, and deeply penetrating, buried its point in his lungs, and gave him a mortal wound. The son of Arcens stood, conspicuous in his armour and finely embroidered tunic of a bright Spanish rust red. A handsome fellow he was, had grown up in the woods of his mother about Simithus River, where stands the Palices' rich and reverenced altar. Him, then, his father Arcens had sent. Downing his spears, Mezentius now whirled his buzzing sling 3 times around his head on a tense thong, then shot. And the scorching bullet struck that warrior clean in the forehead, splitting it open and laying him out full length on the ground. This, so legend tells, was the first time that Ascanius fired in war the arrows with which he'd been used to terrorize swift-running game. A shot of his struck down the gallant Numanus, whose surname was Remulus. This man had recently taken in marriage the younger sister of Turnus. Today he was strutting in front of the Latin lines, yelling out remarks, some proper, some not, to record. His royal alliance had given him a swelled head, showing off his giant physique and shouting, "You men of twice captured Troy, aren't you ashamed to be once more besieged and cooped up in your ramparts, skulking from death behind battlement? Look at the heroes who make war to win them brides from our people. What god or what lunatic impulse has dragged you to Italy? You'll find no Atreides here, no double-talking Ulysses. We are brought up hard from birth. We take our children young to the river and harden them in the painful ice-cold water. Our boys go hunting all night and tirelessly rove the forests. The taming of horses and archery practice to them are pastimes. Our young men, inured to hard work and an austere way of living, tame the soil with hoes or rock cities in battle. We live with steel in our hands. Reversing the spear, we use it to belabor the backs of our oxen. Not even old age that cramps others, weakens our mental powers, or impairs our physical vigor. Though our hair be grey, we put on the helmet, and never lose our gusto for carrying off fresh plunder and living upon it. But you, in your dresses embroidered with yellow and loud purple, you, with the hearts of loafers, you devotees of dancing, with frilly sleeves to your tunics and bonnets kept on by ribbons, you Phrygian women, for Phrygian men you are not, run away to Mount Dindymus, where the double-mouthed pipe tweedles for addicts. The timbrels and Berecynthian fife of Cybele call you. Leave fighting to men, I advise you. Relinquish sword-play to others. Ascanius found this fellow's bragging and loud-mouthed frightfulness intolerable. So, drawing back his bowstring of horse-gut with arrow nocked, he took up his stance with his arms extended wide, having first uttered a prayer and a vow to Jove. Almighty Jove, grant me success in this brave venture. I in return will bring to your temple a yearly offering and set up at your altar a bullock with gilded horns, a snow-white bullock standing as many hands high as its mother, one old enough to butt with its horns and paw the ground. The father heard his prayer. From a clear tract of sky he thundered upon the left. Simultaneously twanged the fatal bow, and the arrow sped from the string with a terrible whirr to pass through the head of Remulus, its point transfixing the hollow temples. Now go and mock good men with insolent words. The men of twice-captured Troy send this reply to the Rutuli. No more did Ascanius say. The Trojans hailed his feat with a cheer and shouted for joy. Their morale was raised sky high. Now it happened that long-haired Apollo, throned on a cloud, was looking down from the regions of air at the Italian lines and the settlement. Then he spoke to the triumphant Ascanius. More power to your young valour, my son! You're going the right way to starry fame, O God-born and sire of gods to be. Rightly all destined foes shall be quelled by the house of Assaracus. Troy is not big enough for you. Thus did he say, then launched himself from the heights of heaven, and brushing aside the breezes made his way to Ascanius. He now took on the appearance of aged beauties, a man who had formerly been the squire and trusted household guard of Trojan Anchises. Later, Aeneas made him Ascanius' personal aide. Apollo came as the living image of this old man, the same voice, complexion, and white hair, the same fierce clashing accoutrements, and to the fiery-spirited prince addressed these words. "Son of Aeneas! Let it suffice to have killed Numanus and come off scot-free yourself. Great Apollo has granted you this first distinction, and is not jealous you've won it with his own weapon. But take no more part in the fighting, young prince." So Apollo began. But while he was yet speaking, he went from the sight of men, vanishing into the distance before their eyes, into thin air. The Trojan commanders recognized him for a god, and his arms divine, catching the noise of his quiver which rattled as he flew. So they used the god's authority to deter Ascanius from further fighting, keen though he was, and themselves returned to the combat, risking their lives at the deadly breach of danger. Now the din rises along the walls, over all the defences. They are aiming the vicious bows and spinning the spears. The ground is one great